You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
Well, I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 3rd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Zeynep Tufekci on this Facebook experiment in 2012 on 600,000 to 700,000 users. Also on today's program, a rebroadcast, not for you, but for those who listen to the Ring of Fire radio show I do, of Lawrence Lessig on his May Day pack. Also on today's program, Tad Cochran campaign conference call gone awry. More on these boobs in Murrieta who did not want mothers and children in their community, because it's about family, American family, and law. Tough week for what?
The law.
The law?
It's about the law.
It's about the law. Yeah, we got a interesting email we may read a little bit later in the program. Also on the program, Supreme Court clarifies, yes, it's all contraception. If religious folk have a problem with it, no can use-y, lady. See? Also, the greatest threat to America, of course, now is the gay burgers coming out of Burger King.
I saw a great tweet about that one.
We will get to all that and more. Ladies and gentlemen, it is July 3rd, and you know what that means. We celebrate the day when a great American decided that her talents could best be used not as a sitting governor, but as a national laughingstock for all but the most regressive and mentally challenged. In fact, I don't even think that's fair to say, except for the most mentally challenged right-wingers. And, of course, I'm talking about Sarah Palin, who decided that, yes, it was time to make some money back on July 3rd, 2009, when she quit being governor. A couple of house-cleaning things. One, we'll put a link on Majority FM to the segment I did with Chris Hayes last night. Interesting segment, I thought, about recent polling that shows, or a study that shows, that Americans don't, they leave a lot of their vacation days basically on the table. Thought it was an interesting conversation. We will put a link to that. And also, I should just mention, we had some live wires on the phones yesterday about this immigration stuff. It is unbelievable the level of just, it's just sheer racism, folks.
Yes.
It is just sheer racism. There is no other explanation for this. And when those bunch of former Minutemen protested essentially to intimidate mothers and children. It is just beyond the pale. And to that moron who emailed us, Kevin, please feel free to call in. Kevin, who's okay. Sam Cedar is a moron. Putting on a pseudo-Southern accent to mock people to protect their community and uphold the law in all caps. It is not illegal for a bus full of mothers and children accompanied by immigration officials to drive through that town. So I don't know what law you're talking about. He can't even pronounce the name Marietta correctly.
Which is true.
All right, fair point. Fair point.
I'm going to concede that one.
Fair point. How did this imbecile ever get a job in broadcasting? What a group of liberal idiots. MR is a perfect acronym for you guys.
We still can't figure that one out.
Can't figure that out, which may also mean that we are liberal idiots. Signed, Kevin. I will withhold his last name. From Mission Vallejo, California. Did I pronounce that right, Kevin? Is it Mission Vallejo? That doesn't seem like an American word to me. Vallejo.
We're just simple folk. We don't know what the MR acronym means for other than our show. All right, we know is we want free government services for immigrants.
Maybe MR stands for most respected.
Oh, yeah, it's possible. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Zeynep Tufekci. She is a assistant professor at the UNC, a Princeton CITP fellow, and a Harvard Berkman faculty associate in sociology. Welcome to the program, Zeynep.
Thank you for inviting me.
For those people who aren't familiar with this Facebook study, tell us, give us the details first of the study.
Well, the study is actually a pretty basic study. What they did was they divided about 700, almost 700 Facebook users into two random groups. And they tweaked the newsfeed of one group so that they got slightly more positive posts show up. And they tweaked the newsfeed of the other group so they got slightly more negative, you know, sort of posts containing more negative words to show up. And then they measured whether seeing slightly more positive words and slightly more negative words in your own newsfeed influenced what kind of things you wrote on your own newsfeed, and they found that indeed if you saw slightly more positive stuff from your friends and family and whoever your Facebook friends are, you did respond with slightly more positive words yourself, and same for negative words as well.
And so how do they, I mean, when you say they tweaked it so that more positive posts would, how do they go about doing that? They just simply filter out certain
posts?
Well,
okay, so you have to, yes, they filtered out certain posts, so they hid them. You have to understand that Facebook's newsfeed is curated algorithmically and otherwise, right? That's an opaque process. We don't know. It's called edge rank, and we don't really know how it works because Facebook won't tell us. When you go on Facebook, what you're not seeing is not a random selection of users, I mean friends you have and their posts. What you're seeing is an algorithm that has been, in fact, this kind of the one that got published is probably the tip of the iceberg because the, you know, keeping you coming back to the newsfeed is Facebook's main business model because you're the product that they're going to sell to advertisers, your eyeballs, so they got to keep you coming back. So what they do is they look at what people respond to and what people come back for, and they show you more of that, and they show you less of the stuff that they think will make you not come back to the site. So, I mean, it's sometimes people think they show you happy stuff, but that's not really true. What it appears to happen is that they show you stuff that keeps you engaged. So if you're wondering why your Facebook feed is all drama all the time, well, that's part of the issue is that you're seeing something that's curated algorithmically to you to keep you coming back so that you can be sold to the advertisers.
Interesting. All right. So let's talk about, I mean, the implications of this. I mean, people are obviously upset because they were not aware that this was going on, which, you know, some people argue.
Well, that's what. Yes, that's one part of the question. If you do research generally, academic research, you should tell people what you're doing, and you tell people, you know, you give them means to opt in and opt out. What Facebook has been saying is that, look, our terms of service allow us to do that. And that's not completely false, right? Their terms of service do allow them to do this kind of research. And in fact, if they never ever published again, so we never got to see sort of the academic considerations of the ethics of this kind of research, they're doing this kind of research all the time. I mean, you're just sort of, we got into this controversy because we got to see one study that people found a little disturbing. And to be honest, the study is kind of run-of-the-mill. It's not really that big a deal. In fact, it's not the first study that Facebook published. The one that got me alarmed was the one that showed that that was the voting study, which showed that Facebook can boost voter turnout. Now, it sounds like a great thing. Oh, Facebook can boost voter turnout, more people will vote. And you know, that's not a bad thing, of course, but it means that since Facebook knows a lot about you without even you telling them, the Facebook's algorithms could potentially, and I'm not making the claim they have or they intend to, but their own publications are telling us they could throw a close election, especially in a first-past-the-post country like the U.S., by boosting the voter turnout of the kind of people who are supporters of whoever they want to win and depressing the turnout of the other kind, which both of which seem quite plausible from published studies that Facebook data scientists have published themselves. That's an earlier study. It was published about a year ago, and that actually got me a little more alarmed. I mean, they know a lot about you. They can figure out if you're gay. They can figure out if you're Republican. They can figure out who your close friends are. Complete information asymmetry. And they can impact what you think is happening in your social network because you get to see what they're showing you in the order they're showing you. And since Facebook is so important to, you know, everyday lives of so many people around the world, not just the U.S., so that's sort of been the general concern. And of course, you can have a lot of concern about this specific study. They obviously didn't do a great job with consent because the fact that so many people are upset, it's just at face value says there's an issue here. And they could have done a better job. But even if they do a better job with the next study, you know, they do an opt-in one, and that wouldn't solve the problem. This is the tip of the iceberg of the kind of research they do every day and the kind of power they have and the kind of influence they have. And I think that's the bigger conversation.
Right. I mean, it seems to me it is sort of just a broader awareness of the power of these social networks. And that this power is obviously concentrated in some very specific hands.
Right, and it's not just Facebook, right? Yeah, right. The big sort of Google's rankings are very powerful. You know, think of it, if you're a politician and your first page is incredible, and we have research that shows that what people don't click on the second page and what they see at first impression is very important. And, you know, whatever the algorithm selects or the Google selects, we don't know. These are all black boxes to us. Could greatly influence what people think of a politician. And once again, in a first-past-the-post system where, you know, 1% here, 2% here makes all the difference, this is real power. And I'm not saying this to say any of these companies at the moment are doing anything, you know, sort of illegal or untoward. That's not the point. In fact, it doesn't even matter. What Sheryl Sandberg was asked about, and she said, oh, no, we don't intend to control any elections. Well, to me, the fact that that's a question and we have to take her word on it is a bigger problem. And again, I have friends in the Facebook data science team. It's not some, you know, conspiracy of people who are trying to do evil things. Not at all. A lot of them are former academics. They're concerned about this stuff. It's not that I distrust them. It's just that there is this power in a few companies that are corporations, and these corporations have interests. And what if you say you want to run against something they don't like, and then what happens?
Right. I mean, and let me ask you about this. And I'm a little hesitant to even bring it up because I haven't really tracked this down, but it was just sent to me. And so if you're aware of these folks, maybe you'd have more insight. But in the credits of the study, there's a Jeffrey Hancock from Cornell University who is involved in something called the Minerva Initiative, I guess. Apparently, the one of the funders of a study at Cornell modeling discourse and social dynamics in authoritarian regimes comes from the Department of Defense. And
right. So, look, this is the kind of study that a lot of academics want to do. And unfortunately, there has been a great deal of cuts in funding from the National Science Foundation and other sources. So a lot of academics have been turning to whatever funding sources they can have to do this research. And remember, this research is public research, right? There's not some secret thing. In fact, you know, I'd be much happier in a world where, you know, the Jeff Hancock you mentioned, you know, gets given the data and gets to publish it and we all get to see it, right? That
right.
actually is not a bad outcome. The problem is the data is, the most valuable data is now held by a few corporations. And the science funding to study human behavior online that would come from more neutral sources like the National Science Foundation has been cut and cut and cut. So if you want to do these studies, a lot of people do turn to, you know, there's a lot of Department of Defense funding. There's a lot of corporate interests, you know, who, you know, Coca-Cola funds this kind of research because they want to sell you stuff. So I think it's in the public interest to realize that, one, this is going on. Two, everybody's interested in this, right? It's corporations, it's governments, it's our Department of Defense, it's everybody else's Department of Defense, right? So it's not like, you know, everybody's interested in these new rich data sources, and it's all there. Everybody's interested in these sort of dynamics. And what's happening is, at the same time, academic research, you know, sort of the neutral research is being gutted, and you're losing control of, you know, how do you do this research? The data is held by the corporations. The money is held by, you know, non-scientific, non-neutral sources. And I think those are the big picture questions. You know, I don't really want to feel like, you know, we can all get upset about one study or, you know, sort of
right. I mean, I
target one academic, but really, that's just not the problem. In fact, a lot of the people involved in this study, a lot of the sort of people you cite, they're perfectly fine academics. There's no reason to doubt their integrity. They're not the problem. The problem is the setup we have in which valuable data held by a few corporations that everybody is interested in, and we haven't really had a public discussion of, wait, what's the power here?
Right.
How do we think about this power, and how do we research this power so that the people researching it can speak up, that they're independent and can say, look, this is what we found. Since the study got published, you know, the one of the lead author had this little post on Facebook itself. It was just a couple of paragraphs, and they've just all gone silent. They're not talking, and that's really not in the spirit of public discussion. If they were, you know, I want to hear their point of view. I want them to explain stuff. I want them to talk about what else is going on. That's what the public dialogue should be. But because it's a corporate setting, I don't know. I mean, I don't think they're allowed to talk, which points to
one of the problems. And I should say, yeah. I'm raising this about the Defense Department only because I think, you know, it helps to illustrate the power of these type of social media.
Right. It makes perfect sense.
The Defense Department engaged in this this sort of quasi Twitter in Cuba. There's obviously a control agenda that either a corporation or a government would have, and this clearly illustrates.
Yes, there is,
the
and the thing is,
these things.
Yes, but these things are powerful, and I'm not really surprised. If I were a Department of Defense, I'd be interested in this too, right? I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. And the point is, it's also a point of interest to every government around the world. It's not just ours.
Oh, right, of course.
So it's even more important that the people, you know, who want, we should have these discussions as public. We should have these, you know, research public and published, because it's very true. These things are powerful. I have myself authored a study that shows that Facebook was influential in the initial Egyptian uprising 2 years ago. You know, interviews with activists show that the people who were on social media were the ones that turned up early, which were important to starting the cascade. So these platforms are powerful. They have major impacts in the world. And it would be a pity if we didn't have these conversations and all the funding came from, you know, non-neutral sources and governments and corporations, so that, you know, the research was directed at either selling you more Coca-Cola or, you know, whatever government is researching, whatever their agenda is, rather than understanding, oh, wait, there's these platforms, we use them, they're crucial to politics. Maybe think about what alternatives we could build. Maybe think about how to understand their power. Oh, there's a lot of great questions that need to be answered, and I'm kind of glad that the study sparked this brouhaha. I don't think the study itself is worth.
Yes, no,
if it was
and
just
I agree.
That,
I mean,
if it was just that, I would just say, okay, you know, fine. It's a little bit of an academic brouhaha, but it's not. This is the stuff of life. This is the stuff of politics
for the 21st century. I want to explore these questions a little bit, and we should know that I think that, you know, on some level, because of your involvement, obviously, in studying this stuff, there are assumptions you have about the power of this that I'm not sure that everyone does. And that's why I bring these issue up, because it is one thing that I think people understand that people are familiar with the dynamic that Facebook played a role in the context of the Egyptian Arab Spring. But that is, you know, a distinction between people using this as a tool to connect to other people and to bring people out versus the forces that control these tools in manipulating them in such a way that they get certain outcomes. And so with that, you know, distinction made, and with, you know, hopefully the sort of the broader understanding of the ability that this study, and I imagine other studies that they've done in the past, show, what is it from just a citizen's perspective? What is it that we can do? Is there anything that we can do to minimize this, or is this something that we need to just conscious of?
I don't really have an answer in my back pocket to what to do next, but clearly the public discussion is important, and there are other industries that have conflicts of interest, like pharmaceuticals, right? We're kind of interested in that, their research, and because they have all this power too. And, you know, we take those drugs. This is not that unsimilar. This is something that has real power in the 21st century. And there's, you know, there's questions of electoral power. There's questions of in this case, like it was emotional well-being, even though the effects were minimal, what if the effects were huge? And what if this, you know, they didn't know the effects would be minimal when they started the study. What if, you know, a lot of people got depressed as a result? There's real questions here. And, you know, this needs to happen as a public conversation. I think politicians should be talking about this. I think constituents should be talking about it. We should be looking at our online practices. I think it would be bad if the story just died down as, you know, sort of a Facebook outrage and roll your eyes. This is nothing to roll our eyes at. This is real power. And it's wrong also to focus on just Facebook. It's not just Facebook.
Right.
And again, it's not just this little study, which itself, by itself, I mean, I would object to the consent procedures as an academic. I would say this is not how you do it. But that would be kind of a minor concern in the overall scheme of things. If that were all there, we would just say do better next time and, you know, sort of different, but that wouldn't solve the problem. So I all I can say is, you know, don't treat these black boxes as things that can't be changed. There's people who are programming these things, and these corporations, they're corporations. They're not owners of the Ten Commandments. They can be regulated. They can be opposed. They can change. They can change internally. They can change externally. They can be made to change. I mean, this is the stuff of 21st century.
Right.
We had these things, right? You know, we don't let people put lead in our water. We have regulations for that. We have other mechanisms for that. And that's the sort of, we should just start thinking about how do we deal with real power, that the emergent new power of 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that it's a fairly decent place to start to say you cannot do these type of, I mean, I guess it gets very tricky, right? I mean, because the issue isn't so much that this academic study, in my mind, that is almost the best case scenario, frankly.
Sure. I don't mind. Yeah, I mean, at least when academics do these things, I mean, I'm not beholden to any corporation.
That's right. Why
I can do what I'm just doing, which is I'm just out there
talking
about things.
Can we regulate? Can we say to a Facebook, just for instance, hey, if you do any of this type of study, and where would the line be if we were to say it must be opt-in? Because obviously their whole business model is based on a study like this of some sort at this point, right? Where they're
right. A lot of studies like this. I don't have an answer in my back pocket, but there's a lot of sort of similar models. As I said, the pharmaceutical industry is a model. There's been great op-eds published in all sorts of outlets. There's a lot of awareness. So we can start discussing, maybe hold panels, maybe, you know, this can become a political issue. I mean, I wouldn't presume to say, you know, here's a complicated problem, here's my simple answer, because
right.
There's no simple answer. But, you know, keeping it on the agenda and not looking at this, like the worst sort of response is, and I hear this from a lot of people who roll their eyes and say, well, then get off Facebook, and are all smug about it. But the point is, if you're in the Middle East and you want to do any politics, you've got to be on Facebook. The point is, if you're a college student and you want to volunteer, you want to do anything, you got to be on Facebook. If you're an immigrant and your family's on Facebook, you got to be on your Facebook. So next time somebody just rolls their eyes and say, well, you're an idiot for being on Facebook, you should. That's the worst response, because that kind of puts the whole blame on people who depend on a service that really doesn't have an alternative. I don't have an alternative to Facebook if I want to keep up with people around the world and with parts of my family. I just do not. And if you're in politics in the Middle East, you do not have an alternative. For a lot of age groups, there is no alternative. So what we should not do is just say, oh, you're being an idiot for being on Facebook, and kind of be smug about it. Rather than that, realize this is an important service with that.
Right, and we would never say, you know, we would never say, oh, well, why do we need a regulation that a third party can't tap your telephone if you don't want to be on?
Right.
If you don't want
right.
that, then just
right.
don't be on your
right.
phone.
Yeah, I mean, no, this is the sort of infrastructure of 21st century, so this is important.
And it's interesting because, you know, we interviewed the other day Philip Murawski, who cites a couple of studies by Alana Gershon on the sort of the on Facebook in particular about its sort of it imposes sort of a neoliberal a worldview on people insofar as it is up to them to develop their profiles in such a way that may be sort of distinct from who they are as a human being, and it sort of leads them into creating something that is more attractive to people, you know, that they must essentially market themselves. And the idea that it is up to the individual as to whether or not to engage on Facebook, and then you have to buy into everything that they could possibly do with your information or with your emotions is all on the individual. It seems to me to be an extension of that idea. And obviously this is what we have governments for, is to impose some types of regulations in these instances. I mean, we did it, I think, to a certain extent with subliminal messages in, you know, in TV ads. And so it seems to me that we could do something similar here.
It's possible. Yes, this is a great public discussion to have.
Zeynep Tufekci, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll be playing an interview I did with Lawrence Lessig last week on Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back after this. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Lawrence Lessig. He is a professor at Harvard Law School, director of the Edmund Safra Center for Ethics, and founder of the May Day PAC at mayday.us. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Now, we've talked many times over the years, and I still remember speaking to you. Gosh, I don't know how long ago it was when you had made the decision after developing things like the Creative Commons license to dedicate your energies to figuring out a way to fix our broken democracy. And if I recall correctly, this was before Citizens United. And even at that time, you had come to the conclusion that the problems that the central, I guess, fulcrum of our problems in American politics was money. It may seem obvious to people now, but just give us a sense of why that's the case.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say it's money simply. It's the problem with our current system is the way campaigns raise their money. So members of Congress spend anywhere between 30 and 70% of their time raising money from the tiniest fraction of the 1% of us. I did a calculation for my book, which found that the relevant funders, the funders, you know, who give it a level that members actually care about, are no more than about 150,000 Americans, which is about the same number of people as are named Lester in the United States. So the Lesters of the United States are funding the campaigns, and members of Congress spend all of their time trying to figure out how to persuade them to fund their campaigns. And that dynamic produces a Congress that's not representative or reflective of what the people want. They are overly sensitive and bending to give the funders what they want, and that creates the core corruption that makes it impossible for our government to do anything.
And I want to get into the specific candidates raising money and the way they go about raising money. But what of outside expenditures? I mean, this is becoming obviously in the wake of Citizens United and in the wake of other sort of chipping away at campaign finance, this has become an increasing problem as well. I mean, I remember speaking to Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, and he was explaining that, you know, part of this dynamic, too, is not even the money that you raise, but the idea that someone can walk into your office and say, hey, I just want you to know we're heavily invested in this vote. And if you vote the wrong way, we're going to dump $3 million into your district to make sure that you don't get elected.
Yeah, that dynamic is poisonous because what it does is it leads everyone to begin to line up with big money on their side so that they actually have somebody to defend them if they get attacked by people on the other side. So that problem, this is the problem created by super PACs, is something that we have to address as well. And I actually think the court is going to come around and fix that problem with super PACs. But the thing to keep in view is that even if the court made super PACs or upheld limits on super PACs, we still would have a system where the tiniest fraction of the 1% was funding the campaigns. And the only way we're ever going to fix the democracy that we've got right now, which is basically incapable of doing anything, is to change the way that we fund campaigns. And there's lots of different ways to think about how to do that, to spread out the funder influence so it's not just this tiny fraction of the 1%, but that's got to be the focus of the Democratic work to get a Congress who will actually pass fundamental reform here by 2016.
All right. Well, so let's dig into this, because you wrote a piece, I guess it was last week, on why this needs to be cross-partisan. And you raised this notion of that Democrats – are, generally talk a good game, but when push comes to shove, they either don't have the political power or, frankly, they don't have the political will once they're in office. And I wonder from your perspective, I mean, talk about that for a moment, because I want to dig into that. People need to understand sort of the premise of this notion that it has to be cross-partisan.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that our Congress is now so deeply partisan, just like media is so deeply partisan, that they only think about things in terms of what will help them in their partisan agenda. What will help them raise money for their party so that they can get more seats in Congress, maybe get control of a House again. Depending on which party you're in, that is good news for your party. But if you're talking about this kind of reform, this kind of fundamental reform that will change the way our political system functions, the only way that can ever happen is if it's cross-partisan. So, right now the Democrats are pushing this constitutional amendment by Senator Udall that would reestablish Congress's power to limit contributions and limit expenditures in political elections. And this amendment has zero Republican co-sponsors, and indeed no Republican has co-sponsored any of the amendments that are trying to address Citizens United. So when Senator Reid brings this up on the floor of the Senate, which he's intending to do in August, and force a vote on it, this issue is, of course, catnip to the Democratic base. The Democrats will love it. They'll get really excited about it. They'll be celebrating the fact that, somebody's trying to do something about Citizens United. But it's not actually moving the ball of reform, because, that action will actually harden the partisan divide on this issue. It won't lessen it. And it'll make it harder to think about the conversation that actually brings Republicans into the coalition necessary to pass an amendment, because, an amendment takes 67 votes in the United States Senate, and that means at least a dozen Republicans would have to join a unanimous Democratic vote, which, right now is just impossible to imagine. So the point is that we've got to find a way to build a movement that is not tied to the partisan interest of the Democrats or the Republicans, but instead leverages off the public's recognition that this existing system is broken, and we've got to find a different way to fund campaigns so it doesn't so drastically defeat the objectives of the people and what Congress actually does.
Do you see I mean, obviously, okay, this is obviously not going to pass. Like you say, you need 67 votes in the Senate and then votes in the House. And do you see this as detrimental, or is there any value in terms of raising the issue? I mean, you know, I guess from when I contemplate other measures that I want to see our government adopt, I don't necessarily think that it's a bad thing to have, let's say, a vote that I know is going to fail. I'm just using as an example, you know, expansion of Social Security. This is not going to happen in the near term, but I think that there's value in it being raised in any way possible, because it begins to expand the playing field of what people converse about and contemplate. Do you see no value to that at all?
I'm not saying there's no value. And, in fact, I'm saying, you know, I'm a Democrat. I like the idea that Democrats getting lots of money to run their elections. But what I'm saying is, it's not strategically useful for advancing the objective of bringing about reform of the system, if indeed you've got to bring about reform that's going to be cross-partisan. So, you know, instead of talking about what is an impossible task, you know, passing a constitutional amendment, meaning getting a dozen Republicans to join you to get it out to the states, and then once it's in the states, you've got to get three-fourths of the states to pass it. There are plenty of bills in Congress right now that would bring about a radical change in the way elections are funded that don't require a constitutional amendment. John Sarbanes in the House has a bill called the Government by the People Act, which has more than 155 co-sponsors right now. This bill would create a system of small dollar elections, so public funding to support small dollar elections. So if you give $100 to a candidate who chooses to run her campaign with small contributions only, that gets matched 9-1, so that candidates could have the option of running for Congress without relying on the contributions of the tiniest fraction of the 1%, but instead relying on small contributions and therefore not becoming beholden to any tiny little interest that forces them to think of issues in one particular way versus another. There's a Republican version of this idea, too, that you know, imagines vouchers for small contributions, vouchers to support small dollar-funded candidates that, you know, voters would get. They would hand out parts of it to whatever candidate they like. But once again, it would be a way of funding elections without relying on the tiny fraction of the 1% to fund it. My point is this is actually the kind of solution we could imagine bringing about if we had real leadership focused on the solution, as opposed to, you know, focused on the kind of perpetual partisan war that defines what happens inside of Washington.
And this Sarbanes proposal specifically is not unlike what we have in New York City, in fact, and we were hoping to have in New York State, but sadly that's not happening in the near term, it appears. Professor, can you hang with me through the break? Because we've got a lot more to talk about on this.
Sure.
All right, great. We'll be right back with Professor Lawrence Lessig about his May Day pack at mayday.us. And, of course, the professor is the author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. We'll be back in a sec. We are speaking with Professor Lawrence Lessig. He is the author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. He is the founder of Mayday PAC, which you can find at mayday.us. To date, my understanding is that you've raised over $3 million with about over 15,000 contributions. And Professor, when we broke, we were talking about the fallacy that a constitutional amendment to reverse Citizens United is really doable, and that if we want to do something doable here, we have to support the passage of statute in the House and I guess the Senate that would provide sort of opt-in opportunities for mostly matching funds or perhaps a voucher system where people could earmark part of their taxes to campaigns. And when we broke, I was suggesting that that's similar to a system that we have in New York. Why do you think that those, is it simply that those have more of a chance of passage because the bar is just lower?
Yeah, the bar is lower. And if we could get a Congress that was committed to this kind of reform and we passed it, then we would begin to bring people into Congress who would be interested in bigger reform like constitutional change. So, you know, what the Mayday PAC is doing is we've got a two-cycle strategy. In this cycle, 2014, we're running a pilot campaign in five races to demonstrate people will vote on the basis of this issue. They will throw out, and you know, candidates or incumbents who are not supportive of reform, so that the message becomes clear in Washington that this is an issue people care about, and therefore people in Washington begin to line up on the right side of this issue. But this is just the pilot for a much bigger campaign in 2016, where our objective is to elect a Congress, majority of Congress committed to this kind of fundamental reform, so that the first thing they do in 2017 is to pass that reform so that the next president has a chance to actually do something as opposed to what we've seen Obama stuck with in this current stage of what Francis Fukuyama calls the vetoocracy or the vetocracy of the United States government, which, you know, basically is incapable of doing anything, I believe, because of the way we fund campaigns.
So I have a couple of questions about this strategy. In 2012, my understanding is the Friends of Democracy PAC had at least a similar agenda. You could tell me if it's different, but that's my understanding. And they got elected, I think, seven of eight of their candidates. How many, assuming you get all five here that you're aiming for, and are they, are you planning to do this on, you know, Democrats and Republican? Is that the idea?
Yeah. So we're going to be in five races. We haven't named the races yet, but it's certainly there are certainly Republican opportunities to make an intervention that gets us to the place we need to be in 2016, which is that Democrats and Republicans both are supporting this kind of change. Now, what we're doing is similar to what Friends of Democracy did. Friends of Democracy is doing something in 2014 too. They're going to be in more races. What we're trying to do is to complement their strategy by trying to be in fewer races, but being in these races at a much higher level, so that when mm-hmm. we get finished with this election cycle in January 2015, we can all sit down and we can look at what the data shows works. Like, what does it really take to convince people that we can win on this issue? Because I believe that if we can show people who care about reform real data to support the idea we can have real change, then we can raise the funds necessary in 2016 to bring about that kind of change.
Is this going to require from activists on both sides of the aisle? But, you know, I mean, I think most of the people listening to this program tend to vote Democratic or a candidate perhaps to the left. But is this going to require that people basically eat it on other issues? In other words, does this have to be for people the primary single issue vote? I mean, I assume that's what it is for you guys. But to show that this can work and then ultimately to carry it through to its completion in 2016, does this have to be like the single issue?
Well, you know, I wouldn't try to persuade people to give up, you know, the other issue that really motivates them. So if you care about climate change, then, you know, I wouldn't say give up your work on climate change. But I think what people have got to recognize is that unless we get this issue fixed, then none of these other substantive issues people care about, whether it's climate change or the debt or tax reform or whatever, are ever going to get sensibly addressed in our current political system. So we need to take enough energy from these other movements to make it possible for us to build this reform movement. And with that reform movement, you know, when it's successful in getting a Congress that passes the fundamental reform, then it will be possible to, you know, to pass the kind of changes that one, you know, wants in the context of, for example, climate change, the issue that's so important to me. And I think that, you know, people are constantly saying, no, we got to get, we got to deal with the substantive issue. That's the really important thing. But look, we're going to go through 8 years of the Obama administration and not one single substantive statute will have been passed to address in a fundamental way the problem of climate change, an issue which in 2008 both parties basically admitted was an issue that had to be addressed. By the end of this two-term administration, it will not have been addressed, and it will never be addressed so long as the entities which make more than $100 billion in profit every year, given the current unregulated system, have the ability to leverage that profit to stop reform. So we've got to change...
Lawrence Lessig, the site is mayday.us. For the Mayday Pack, we will touch base with you again as we get closer to that election. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks. The vagaries of AM talk radio and my relearning when I've got to get out of an interview, basically. More or less, I think we got the point from Lawrence Lessig, and I wanted to make sure that we played that, particularly after, you know, talking to Brian Knappenberger about Aaron Swartz, because in my understanding is essentially that Aaron Swartz was, in many respects, the catalyst for Lessig taking this on. So let's take a quick break. Folks, a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. We couldn't do the first half of the show or the second half of the show without you. And as a way of saying thank you, we provide you with an extra 40, 50 minutes of content a day. Become a member at majority.fm. Folks, have a great July 4th weekend. We will have no show tomorrow. We're all taking the day off. I'm like taking 2 days off in the sense that I'm not going to do either show tomorrow. Yeah, that's how crazy I'm going to be. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. We get a little kickback. Speaking of kickback, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon junk through that. We get a little kickback. Thus, MajorityReportKickback.com. Okay, folks, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM me via the app or any of our legacy IMs. We'll be back in a moment.